In this week's program, the reflections of a Middle East historian. Bernard Lewis, Professor Emeritus at Princeton, is 95. Born in England of Jewish parents, most of his work in Islamic history has been in the Ottoman and modern periods, but he began as a medievalist. He's been both a scholar and advisor to politicians. He came to the knowledge of a wider public in 1990 with the publication of an article in Atlantic Monthly called The Roots of Muslim Rage. Bernard Lewis's name will forever be associated with that of his arch-critic Edward Said, who regarded Lewis as the leader of a group he called Orientalists. Said regarded this group of scholars as the intellectual wing of Western imperialism in the Islamic world. And for his part, Lewis argues that Edward Said, through his acolytes, has continued to exercise unhealthy control over the direction of Middle Eastern studies in Western universities. With me, Noel Dorr, former Irish diplomat and author of Ireland and the UN, and a seat at the top table. Dr. Francesco Cavatorta, senior lecturer in the School of Law and Government at DCU, and Bridget Laffan, professor of European politics at UCD. Bridget Laffan, what did you make of this?
I enjoyed the book, and I enjoyed it for many reasons. Firstly, he's 95, and the fact that he can still write like this, and also the subtlety with which he wrote. And I think the book tries to do a number of different things. It's a memoir, but it's not a particularly personal memoir. So you, from time to time, paragraphs, etc., etc., one hears about his family and background. But what he's doing here, I think, is his statement of how he does scholarship, how a historian should do scholarship. I think he also is doing two other things. He's setting the record straight on a number of issues, particularly in his final chapter or penultimate chapter on the Iraq War. And one could also argue that he's settling scores. So I thought it was a rich book. I thought that in terms of how he goes through what he regards as the role and task of a historian and how history should be done, I found really interesting.
And Noel Dorr, what did you think of it?
I agree largely with what Bridget has said. It is a memoir, a bit anecdotal at times, but very interesting. I grew to respect him as a scholar, and I'm very interested in his amazing knowledge of languages and so on. But I feel the other aspect of the book is a bit of self-justification about his recent role in relation to policy, in relation to the Middle East. And I think he's to be respected as a scholar, but to be questioned and rather doubted as an analyst of American, or at least an advocate of certain American policies. For instance, in relation to Iraq, where he seemed to want a breakaway from the northern zone under Saddam and the setting up of some kind of a free state in Iraq, which the West would support. I find all that rather dubious. I actually, without name dropping, I can say that I once met him long ago. I used to attend a small discussion group in Oxford on occasion, and he turned up on one occasion as a guest. I can't remember him very vividly, except that I was enormously impressed at his range of scholarship and languages. But I'm a little more dubious, as I said, about his justification for his policy position. And that takes you, of course, into Said and the controversy
and
that he's got
that,
into.
Which we'll talk about later. Francesco Cavatorta, your reaction to the book?
Well, I kind of tend to disagree with the previous speakers. I didn't particularly enjoy the book. I thought it was rather dull, a bit self-justificatory in many ways. Just, I don't know. I found maybe the bits about how he looks at scholarship and how he does his work and how he relates to the students as the most interesting part. What scholars should be, what scholars should be doing. And the rest, I didn't find it particularly interesting. I thought there was a lot of sweeping statements that hide the complexity of what, in fact, particularly the field of Middle East studies should be really about. So I was not enthused by the book.
Let's What's your sense way. Of how good a scholar he is?
Oh, he's an excellent scholar. There's no doubt about that. There's an excellent scholar, but he's an excellent scholar because of other stuff that he wrote. Certainly not going on this biography. He's a very good scholar. He's an excellent historian. Just like Noel said, I would question his transition from historian to advisor to policymakers. I think I don't think he's as good or as efficient in that.
But I think I don't regard it as a comprehensive autobiography. I think it's a memoir, and we must remember it's the memoir of someone who's 95. Mm. And so I think we should take it within its own terms. And what I agree with Francesco when he said, I found particularly Why Study History, Chapter 5, really interesting. And this is someone who believes profoundly in the value of history.
But isn't it odd in the light of that, Bridget? And he highlights that, of course, and it's a compelling chapter that he has such a deep row with Edward Said, given that, you know, he's saying history, the historian should not be a propagandist and so on. And in a sense, that's what he's being accused of by Said.
Well, I think that was one of the great academic clashes of the 1970s and 80s. And apparently they met once at the US Middle Eastern Studies Association, and someone called it the standoff at the Mesa Corral. Yeah. I think apparently it was actually the engagement was quite civil between them. But I just think they talked past each other. I don't think they engaged seriously with each other and the perspectives from which they were coming. And I think for Lewis, he talks a lot about historical accuracy. He talks a lot about evidence. And one of the sentences that I thought was truly very elegant in the book was, you ask questions of the evidence and then, preferably without the use of torture, you extract answers.
Yes, that's
and
a good line.
And I thought it was a beautiful...
I just want to clarify this. I mean, what did Said object to most, Francesco? What was your sense in what Lewis was doing?
Well, I think the objection is on two grounds. One is scholarly objection, as one is a political objection. There's no doubt that they had deep political divergences about United States foreign policy and Western foreign policy in general in the region. Also, I think there are two personal histories coming to play. Said saw himself as a Palestinian refugee, and in many ways he was right. He was a Palestinian refugee, strong supporter of the Palestinian cause, a strong supporter of the national liberation program of the Palestinians. Lewis was in some way the opposite. He's a strong supporter of Israel. He's got links with the American foreign policy establishment that obviously supports Israel. So, and on top of that, I think they had profound differences about the way in which one would look at the Middle East. I think Said was in some ways offended that Orientalists or Western scholars, the so-called Orientalists, would go into the region and try to extract some sort of essence about Islam, about the Arabs, about Muslims. And what I think he objected to is the idea that that there is an essential Islam Arab mind that these Orientalists wanted to extract.
His position would be
that there's a lot more complexity within Islam and within the Arab world than essentializing simply through religion.
So it's a matter of opting for a more complex approach rather than one that's reductive an approach is that focuses on the essence of a Catholic.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's like to say, you know, all the Irish are the same or all Catholics are the same and so on.
Noel, what was your sense of that debate?
Well, I hadn't read Said. And I started with a disposition to think that Said was probably right, a kind of sympathy for Said, sort of speaking for the oppressed and all that sort of thing. I then dipped into Said, Orientalism, his book Orientalism and Exchanges in the New York Review of Books in about 8 or 9 years. I can't remember when Said died, but Exchanges in the New York Review of Books in any case. And I came to realize that Said was a bit over the top. It was kind of a cry of rage, and perhaps not terribly coherent at times. And on the issue of historical scholarship, obviously Lewis could completely put him down. He picked up a number of mistakes that Said made, fairly obvious mistakes. And they had a strange dispute about the meaning of an Arabic word. I think it's Torah, which means a camel getting up from lying down or something like that. How you apply that to the idea of revolution. So I came away with the feeling that certainly Lewis had won the argument in historical scholarship. But on the other side of it, I think the charge against Lewis is not one that he's one of Orientalists over generation who have sort of justified Western imperialism in the Arab world, but rather his current, over the past, say, 10 years, his current position. And here, again, I quote from something in the New York Review of Books, a man who writes frequently there called Ian Borrema, and he put it very well, I thought. He said, Bernard Lewis has never been afraid to dip his scholarly hands in the muck of current affairs. And then he goes on to say, there is often a chasm between scholarly and political acumen. So I think Lewis has political acumen, or scholarly acumen, And I think he had much the best of the argument with Said, although I started with a sympathy for Said. But I think the real charge that I would, or the real worry I would have about Lewis, is his belief that he can apply all that to current Middle Eastern policy. And of course, he knew all the great and the good. He knew a succession of Israeli leaders. He met Nasser. He knew the Shah of Persia. He spent 3 hours with the Shah.
Also, we should have, just as a footnote there, I was intrigued to learn that, you know, he was consulted by Dick Cheney, asked for his advice, but Lewis did not support the second invasion of Iraq. Many people thought he did, but he didn't, just as a footnote.
Well, there's a strange anomaly there, yeah, in his own book. In successive pages, he's talking about his thesis that the US should have support at the time when no-fly zones were established, and the north and south, particularly the north, the Kurdish area, where there are also some Shiite Arabs, as he says, became kind of almost self-governing. He wanted the Americans and the West generally to support some kind of a new free government of Iraq. I can't remember his term. And then 2 pages later, he's talking about Cheney and the charge that he might have supported the invasion of Iraq. There's a contradiction
policy
there.
Policy is not his strong suit.
He was pushing for certain things, but not for the invasion.
I think that one needs to be careful here, because in essence, the no-fly zone allowed the creation of a pretty autonomous region in northern Iraq that was actually well-governed so I think what he was saying is an all-out invasion of Iraq was not likely to succeed and would bring a lot of instability, but that there needed to be some zone within that country in which people could be, particularly the Kurds, could be safe.
Just not to get lost in the policy questions, and of course clearly they are important and we'll discuss them in more detail later, but just some of the things that Lewis has said, it struck me, Bridget, for example, that when he says the capacity for empathy to vicariously experience the feelings of others is a peculiarly Western feature. It produces the desire to know other civilizations. The implication there is that, you know, you don't get that in the Islamic world.
Yes, and and again, I think that is an example.
Yeah, isn't it?
That is one of the criticisms that one can make of
it. No, but if you remember maybe the history of the war in Vietnam, one of the generals of the American army, when asked about the carpet bombing and so on, he said, well, because the Vietnamese, surely they don't value life as we do in the West.
Yes.
There is this attitude, and I think this is what Said was questioning. He was not questioning Bernard Lewis as a scholar or as a linguist or as an expert on his scholarship. I think he was questioning this particular attitude of extracting, you know, an essence out of Muslims or Islam or Arabs to come out then with this kind of very facile
statements. Surely has political ramifications. I mean, you can't divorce in an absolute way the scholarship, critical scholarship, from a political posture.
And that was Said's point, I think, in the end of... And that's why Orientalism was such a big hit.
To be fair, he's not just Said was not just talking about Lewis. He's talking about a whole generation of Orientalists.
And he was one of them. I mean, another thing struck me, this is Lewis talking. When the first Western archaeologists went digging in the Middle East, many Muslims were mystified. To the Muslims, this was pre-Islamic history and therefore not significant. Again, he's putting them down in that sense of their lack of interest in scholarship. Noel, did he have any insight about the Israeli Palestinian conflict? Does Lewis have anything of interest to say there?
I think that's one of the great things missing in his book. He does talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but only in terms of the term Palestine. He traces it from early times and then the Romans and the Byzantines and so on, and whether it had died out and all of that. But he really doesn't face the whole... And it seems to me that the centre, at least an important issue and maybe a central issue in what he calls the Muslim rage or the Islamic rage, whatever the term he uses, is the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And I would have wanted to hear him talk about, for instance, the question of settlements and his ideas for a kind of settlement. Interestingly, he met Gaddafi, and Gaddafi, he tells us, supported a one-state approach in which Jews and Arabs would live together in a single state. And he even gave a name to it, Israeteen or something like that.
Was it Gaddafi who said, next time come without your wife? Is that right?
Yeah. No, he didn't say that I remember. I don't think so.
It was one of his advisors.
But to have omitted any real discussion of that. And for instance, then when he talks about Iran and the Shah, whom he spent a lot of time with and knew fairly well, he makes no reference to the coup in 1953, I think, which overthrew Mossadegh, which was engineered by Kermit Roosevelt by the CIA. I think it's not controversial to say that now. That's public knowledge now and has been written about. But no reference to that. So there's a lot of big omissions there that I think I would fault him for in current policy issues.
There's a lot more in the book, for example, on the prospect of a peace agreement with Egypt than there is on Palestine. And I think that's because he feels more comfortable in dealing with Israel and the border issues and the territorial issues than he is with dealing with Israel and its where it is.
He mentions that he could persuade neither Golda Meir in 75 nor Moshe Dayan that the Egyptians were ready to talk.
He has a certain sense of his own importance as a potential actor in current political issues, because I think he's almost claiming that for quite a while, as you said, he was trying to persuade Israeli leaders that the Egyptians and Sadat were ready to talk. And Golda Meir didn't quite believe him, Dayan didn't quite believe him, and so on. And it was Begin, whom he calls a small-town lawyer, who eventually, in secret negotiations with Sadat, which took the Americans by surprise, incidentally. Yeah. He says that came as a surprise to the Americans. And he was in Brzezinski, the National Security Advisor's office in the White House, when the news came through. And he quotes Brzezinski as saying, "It's never going to work, because Begin won't give them anything," and so on.
There is a kind of line here, Francesco, in the matter of Islamic global ambitions. You know, he says, the collapse of the Ottoman Empire meant the end of Islam's second imperial try. What's happening now is a third attempt by Muslims to bring God's revelation to all of humanity, this time not by invasion and conquest, but by migration and demography. That's a kind of line, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, that's the kind of right-wing line that we get in Europe, that we get in the United States about, you know, Islam wanting to take over the world. I can't really follow that kind of thinking. I don't see the expansion of Islam. I see people who might be Muslim, or maybe we call Muslim, but they're not really Muslim, because there could be Muslim that don't believe in God, and there's plenty. So it's this kind of...
But to what extent can a view like that coexist with meticulous, detailed scholarship?
I think the problem for Lewis, and I think for a lot of historians of the Middle East, also political scientists of the Middle East, is that when they move away from their scholarship and they tend to go into public pronouncements, they have to make it in some way simple for the audience. They can't go into the complexity that they can go into when they do scholarship. And I think a lot of it therefore gets lost in some way in translation from scholarship to the public domain. And I think Lewis has incurred in this problem as well, because then he gets into the roots of Muslim rage, even the title, the roots of Muslim rage. Do we really think that there's a billion Muslim running around the place completely mad? I don't see it. I'm sure there are some who are completely mad, but...
But you can see how views like that can feed in a lot into Western insecurities, Bridget.
Absolutely. And I think he does acknowledge in the book that he's dealing with a very sensitive area. Mm-hmm. And I think for Europe and the United States, obviously, the Middle East the Near East Middle East is very sensitive. But again, when he begins to talk like that, I just don't think it's very helpful, either in terms of plotting the way in which these parts of the world can evolve.
But there is an empirical matter. It's an empirical question, isn't it? The extent to which a claim like this is true or not. For example, by the mid-20th century, a growing awareness in the Islamic world of a common Muslim identity and of a common shared enemy in the global world of unbelievers, that's something that can be tested or found out, counted, ultimately.
Well, you can. I mean, if you look at election results, for instance, now we have them. We finally have free and fair election results from the Middle East. We look at Tunisia. 37% of people voted for a reasonably moderate Muslim Islamist party that has kind of religion as its reference, if you want to. The rest voted for non-religious parties, and 50% of people didn't show up at the polls. So it sounds and it looks exactly like Western Europe.
There's another point that the Islamic world is much wider than the Middle East. Is he talking about Arab rage because of the carving up of the Ottoman Empire after the First World War and all that followed? Or is he talking about places like Indonesia, Malaysia and so on? I mean, he applies this term in a very broad way.
Can I just pick Francesco up on something? I mean, I don't think you can compare elections in the Middle East. You can compare at a pro forma level the outcome of an election in Tunisia with an election in Europe in comparative politics terms. But there is a longevity of institutions and serial elections in our part of the world that is missing. So I think we need to be careful that you also need to, in order to do justice to the complexity of what's happening in the Middle East, it is important to look at how this part of the world can democratize, what institutions it will require and processes. And elections are only one part of that.
Oh, no, I don't disagree with that. But I mean, if you take the first free and fair elections in Italy in 1948 or in Germany, a big, huge Christian Democratic Party with very conservative values wins the election.
Sure.
The rest of society either doesn't show up at the polls or votes for left-wing parties. Yeah. Tunisia in 2011 gives us exactly the same results. Yeah. So I don't see this first overarching role that he gives to religion and to Islam in politics. It's an important role. Nobody denies it.
He's been influenced by Huntington a lot in that.
I think it's more the other way around.
I mean, Huntington, I know that the 1990 article that influenced Huntington, didn't it? The
Clash of Civilization.
The roots of Muslim religion and so on. But on that point, who influenced whom?
Lewis claims in the book that he first used the term Clash of Civilizations in 1957, I think it was in the Atlantic Monthly.
Yeah. So he also
says that Huntington acknowledged that it was he, Lewis, who had originated the term.
Okay, well, let me put it another way without invalidating my argument. it's that they're in agreement of one mind in the matter, Bridget. You know, that religion is at the root of all global conflicts, essentially, that view.
Yes, and he ascribes to Islam a sense in which he said Christianity and Islam are the two great monotheistic religions, but that in Christendom there was render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's and to God that which is God's. In other words, that in Islam you don't get a separation of church and state and can't, etc., etc. And I think, again, it's much more complex, and that part of the world, countries of predominant Muslim populations, are very different. And I think to read, you know, this great singular interpretation.
I noticed that they both have doubts about the relevance of democracy in the Muslim world.
Before we leave religion, I just quote a nice little phrase that he has. He says about Islam and Christianity, they differ very much in their view of heaven, but their view of hell is both the same.
All our view of hell. But that question of Huntington and Lewis are of one mind that democracy may not be all that helpful in the moment. But you know, what you need is perhaps some kind of authority that makes use of wide consultation rather than democracy itself. I mean, they both tend to that view.
No, in some ways I agree with Bridget when she says that the institutions that will be brought about in the Middle East and the Arab world in general will be probably different from the institutions that we have here. The legislation will be different. The degree of, let's say, human rights, personal freedoms will be different that we have here now, because what we had 50 years ago isn't exactly what we have now. We struggle to have this amount of personal freedoms. So I think he is right in the sense that there will be different political institutions, but they will have some sort of democratic government. If by democratic government you mean simply a mechanism through which an electorate votes in representatives that are in some way accountable to the same
changed. I mean, in fairness to him, he does say that pre-modern Islamic regimes were more open.
Much more open.
In consultation.
His approach would be consultation, I think, as you said, Andy. Yeah. He talks about that as a kind of traditional approach in the Middle East.
That was obscured by later totalitarian regimes.
His argument
regimes,
is that concepts like freedom and democracy were not fully understood in the Middle East. Freedom, he says, for the Islamic world, was the opposite of slavery.
He winds up on a pure Henry Kissinger note where he says the aim should be to maintain stability in Islamic countries and ensure they're ruled by friendly rather than hostile tyrants. I mean, that's straight out of Henry Kissinger.
And he wants tough talking from the West. He quotes with apparent approval at one stage. I can't remember who he quotes. Someone says, we may not know what is in the mind of the Oriental, but we should ensure that he knows what is in our mind, unquote. That's really a very patronising and rather dangerous approach. And
he should know what we think, yes. So, Bridget.
I was also struck in places that he talks about the repression of women as having caused enormous damage to Islamic society. And that, in a sense, that the uneducated and downtrodden mothers were left to raise the next generation. And I think one has to ask, and here I ask Francesco, who is a specialist on the politics of this region, how are women faring post the Arab Spring?
Not well. But they never did. That is the problem. I think we have this assumption that they did well before, but they don't. But they don't necessarily fare well simply because of religion. They don't fare well because of poverty, because of high unemployment. And like in most conservative traditional society, if there is one job to go for, the male will get it because he fulfills the traditional role. But that's usually independent from religion.
Isn't that the problem with Lewis's overall model? There isn't much room for economics or even politics. It's largely a matter of religion, yes, and culture.
Yeah, absolutely. And although he from time to time talks about the importance of social and economic history, it is for others to do.
I think what he misses in his book is something that is slightly different from democracy, which is the word liberalism. We have become more liberal society in terms of individual personal freedoms. We have equality legislation regarding gender, sexual discrimination no longer exists, and so on. These societies, especially in the Arab world, are not liberal. But outside Europe, very few countries are actually liberal.
We've been discussing Notes on a Century, the Reflections of a Middle East Historian by Bernard Lewis, published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. My thanks to Noel Doerr, Bridget Laffan, and Francesco Cavatorta.